Okay, well, good morning, everyone. I'll maybe just do a recap in case you're new to these sessions, just to sort of highlight where we have been. Okay, so we started on Monday really looking at Psalm 91, just really looking at that whole concept of the mystery of suffering. And then yesterday, we looked at Psalm 22 and looked at the whole complexity of suffering. And today we're looking at Psalm 46. It's a reasonably short psalm, so I'll read it to us if you just listen in for a moment. So God is our refuge and strength, an ever-present help in trouble. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth give way, and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea. Though its waters roar and foam, and the mountains quake with their surging. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy place where the Most High dwells. God is within her, she will not fall. God will help her at break of day. Nations are in uproar, kingdoms fall. He lifts his voice, the earth melts. The Lord Almighty is with us, the God of Jacob is our fortress. Come see the works of the Lord, the desolations he has brought on the earth. He makes war cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the shields with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. We just pray just for a moment. Lord, as we try together as your pilgrims in the 21st century to understand the psalm, to make it applicable to our daily walk, enlighten us by your Spirit. In Jesus' name, amen. When Joyce and I are back home on the island of Ireland, I have a partnership relationship with an organisation called Glencree Peace and Reconciliation Centre. Just sits a little bit south of Dublin in the Wicklow Hills. And they were established in the early 1970s really as an organisation, not necessarily coming at peace and reconciliation from any very distinctly faith perspective, but creating a space in the Wicklow Hills for uncomfortable or difficult conversations to take place. And I remember 2 years ago being down there and a group of people in a room, mostly from the British Protestant Unionist Loyalist tradition, just telling their stories, stories of immense pain. And Joyce was in the centre but didn't join the meeting. And I remember over dinner that evening just saying that they were so intense. You know, 7 hours of painful stories of terrorism, of loss, of agony. I remember speaking to some people, the IRA's border campaign that took place within their ideology was really a whole concept of trying to ethnically cleanse British Protestants from the border areas that straddled the Republic. And I remember promising those folk, look, I would bring a group from Belfast, which is obviously our urban centre, to there and doing this almost macabre, I guess, border tour of different sites where people had died. You know, stories of wives holding rifles, guarding their husbands while they drove the tractor in the field. Just very painful stories. And I just remember us going down and spending that day there really in a process of listening and trying to understand. I suppose in my context there are the big sort of headliners, if I was to say to you, like Bloody Sunday. Most folk here in the American context would remember that. Bloody Friday, Le Mans, McGurk's Bar. The Kingsmill Massacre was another horrific story that took place quite a number of years ago in the early 1970s. And in preparing this sermon, I remember sort of delving and reading around that once again because it's a very live issue still at the moment. And just this extract from the Belfast Telegraph just gives some insight into how do you deal, or is it even possible to deal with the storms of life? So the journalist just simply says this, Alan Black, who is Alan Black? He was the only survivor of one of the worst atrocities of the IRA in the 70s. And he's counting down the days, he says, in dread. On the morning of January the 5th, the sole survivor of Keynes Mill will log the hours, then the minutes, until it is 5:30 p.m. 40 years later, he says, and I can think of nothing except how long now did the boys have left to live? He said, I see their faces on that fateful journey from the Glen Ann textile factory where they worked to their Bessbrook homes. He says the conversation was great. We were arguing about would Manchester United challenge Liverpool to win the English First Division. And then all of a sudden in the darkness, a person with a torch walks out and stops our little minibus on a deserted part of the road. All of a sudden, 11 armed men appear with combat jackets, blackened faces from the hedges. The workers ordered out of the minibus. And one gunman asks if there are any Catholics step forward. And fearing it was maybe loyalist paramilitaries or terrorist groupings, there was only one Catholic worker. His name was Richard Hughes. And the Protestant workmen feared he was going to be shot. And Walter Chapman, and I remember this story graphically being told to me, as they stood against the van and were lined up, he put his hand on the Catholic's hand and he said, say nothing, pretend you're one of us. But one of the IRA gunmen recognized Richard Hughes, the solo Catholic, and ordered him to run down the road, and then the shooting began. And Alan, commenting on that, he said, you know, for years, I didn't tell the truth to protect the bereaved. I said it was over quickly, they started shooting, no one suffered. And it's only in the last 2 years or so, he's been able to tell the truth completely. He said it wasn't like that. He says the men didn't die in the first round of fire. I can still hear them screaming in fear and agony. The gunmen again shot everyone in the head to finish them off as they lay on the ground. After that, there was no screaming, only silence. I knew I was the only one alive. And a total of 136 shots were fired. Despite being hit 18 times, Alan survived. He says, the final bullet into my head didn't penetrate my skull. He said, I remember being in awful pain and the rain trickling down my cheeks. I was grateful for the rain because my body felt literally on fire. I must have been lying on the roadside 30 minutes before the ambulance came. It felt like eternity. In Uri's Daisy Hill Hospital, he said a Catholic priest, Father Henry Devlin, was waiting. Alan said he asked my religion and if I wanted the last rites. I told him I didn't. I'm a Protestant, but I said, don't leave me. He took my hand and he held it all the way to the operating theatre. He visited me every day until I left hospital. Alan admits quite openly, for a time I didn't want to live. The loss of the boys hit me hard. I wasn't even well enough to go to their funerals. I lost the will to live and began deteriorating really rapidly. A young nurse, Anne Hannaway from County Cavan, noticed what was happening. She kept talking to me about my baby daughter. What about Karen? You have to live for Karen. He said, I guess that's probably what pulled me through. He says, after my release from hospital, life remained torturous for me. Taking my two sons to school, I would meet the Keynes Mill widows and the children who had no fathers. It was too much. I went home after that, got into bed and simply pulled the blankets over my head. I moved to Scotland for 2 years. There was no one there who knew me, no one to talk about Keynes Mill. I stayed there until I felt able to come home and deal with things. Today, he says, I'm immensely proud that despite what happened. Catholics and Protestants do live together in harmony in Bessbrook. Colin Warden's brother Kenneth, 24, was killed at Keensmill, but he's never been able to ask Alan about his last moments alive. He said, "I know it's wrong, but I resented that Alan survived and Kenneth didn't." Colin said, "I was 15. I was a kid. When my big brother died, I literally worshipped him." He left a wife, two wee daughters. And the daughter said, "Will you be my daddy now?" And his brother's horrific injuries haunt Colin to this day. Kenneth had no face left. It was blown away in the gunfire. He said, "In war, both sides are meant to be evenly matched. These men have nothing to fight with except their lunchboxes and their tea flasks." Cecil Chambers' youngest brother, Robert, was among the dead. "The policeman at the morgue wouldn't let me see him," he says. Another relative went in. He said it was like a butcher's shop with bodies lying on the floor, literally like slabs of meat. "Robert was the last one of us living at home. His death destroyed my parents. For years, my mother kept cooking him dinner. My father was at the grave morning, noon, and night." May Quinn's brother, Bobby Walker, aged 46, was driving the bus. She says, "You couldn't find a better person. He was always fixing a neighbor's tractor, cutting a hedge, hands for most tasks." The photo hangs in May's home. "I couldn't bear to look at it all day in the living room. I'd be crying all the time. The pain is as raw as ever." I'm 81. Bobby's wife died 2 years ago. The authorities think when all the victims and the bereaved are dead, they'll be free of the problem of dealing with the past. She says, "I want to meet my brother's killers. They put 19 bullets into a person who never harmed a soul. I'd like to ask them why. They must be getting on in years themselves. I hope their consciences kick in and they come forward and repent." Jean Lemon was waiting for her husband Joe, age 49, to come home when she heard the sound of ambulances racing to King's Mill. "When I found out there was a shooting and one survivor, like all the women, I prayed, 'Please, Lord, let it be my man.' But Joe didn't come home. Our daughter Shirley was getting married and the white envelopes were coming through the letterbox. Some were accepting wedding invitations, others were sympathy cards. My two granddaughters were to be the flower girls at the wedding. They had their dresses ready to show Joe that night, but he never got to see them. Jean is 92. Failing eyesight and hearing, but I hope still to be around for the inquest that's been ordered in the King's Mill. I want to hear the truth, however awful. It's 40 years, but I miss Joe as much as ever. There's an emptiness in my heart that has never been filled." And so that's my work when I'm home in Ireland, listening to stories, listening to pain, dealing with the legacy of the past, of hundreds of years of religious sectarianism and political inability to deal with difference. But storms come in so many different ways. Mom, Dad, I'm 14, I'm pregnant. And your world caves in. "You know, honey, it's about time you woke up. I've been having an affair for 6 months. I'm not in love with you anymore, and you're completely devastated." Or your son is down here at the police precinct on a drugs charge, and the bottom drops out of your life. So, I mean, the list is endless, I guess, if I went round the room: divorce, miscarriage, business failure, rebellious daughter, chaotic son, job, relationship problems. You get that kind of empty feeling in the pit of your tummy. I feel my world is caving in. Psalm 46, I think, wrestles with some of those questions. How do I weather the storms of life? Because all of us at some stage face some form of major calamity. It's not a question if, it's a question of when. So initially, we've talked about this, wrestled with it. We don't have any concrete answers, and we're not going to get them too much today. But dealing with the why. December 26, 2004. You remember the tsunami in Southeast Asia? And columnist Eric Zorn offers his questions and attempts some answers. He said this: did the tsunami reflect the will of God? Or was God powerless to stop it? If it was God's will, what moral lesson can we possibly accept from an entity for whom individual human life is evidently so expendable? Why isn't constant fear the only sensible attitude towards such a God being? Either way, what does it mean to trust God or have faith in God when in seconds on a sunny day, a crushing wave from the deep can snatch a loved one literally from your grasp and drown him? Oh, trust that it's part of some bigger plan that mere mortals cannot begin to access, let alone comprehend. Does the grand mystery notion fit well enough for you or for me? So the guy writing this article in the Chicago Tribune says, I call my outlook, he says, indifferent agnosticism. I don't know if God exists and I don't care. God's will and design for this temporal and spatial vastness, if any, is so patently, deliberately impenetrable that I doubt any mortal on this planet has even a grasp on it. He says the very inexplicability of sad events like the tsunami, the AIDS crisis, or even the cancer death of the father of one of my daughter's second grade classmates last week are to me reminders to focus on our obligations to one another. Not to the infinite, to honour the Creator, if any, by honouring creation itself and hoping that's good enough. Why do storms happen? Let me try to painfully attempt some answers. I suppose some storms in life are self-inflicted, okay? In other words, they're caused by our own sins and mistakes. God has given us all the power of choice, and sometimes the choices we make lead to trouble. The great Irish playwright Brendan Behan, I remember a couple of years ago, we have this thing in January during those dark, long, depressive North European days called Out to Lunch. And Joyce and I went down to the Black Box to see a play about Brendan Behan and Patrick Kavanagh, who drank every night, literally in pubs in Dublin, were downing 6 to 8 pints of Guinness every night. And it was just a 2-hour play, two men sitting, drinking pints of Guinness and talking about life. Brendan Behan died when he was 41 years of age, obviously through too much abuse of alcohol. And I've heard other people who were maybe 40 cigarettes a day smokers take cancer and then say, I'm a good person. How could God do this to me? And I suppose, although I didn't say it, I couldn't help but wonder why God is getting the blame for your lung cancer. As much as it hurts to admit it, the truth is that many of the hurts you experience and I experience, they're self-induced. They're caused by my own sin, by my own mistakes. Another cause of these storms are bad choices or evil actions of others. We have conversations in the last couple of days about the Holocaust or the Shoah. that poses the ultimate question of the evil actions of others. And sometimes people ask, why does God allow these kind of things to happen? And the answer is that all of us in this room are free to make choices, good or bad, and sometimes innocent people suffer because of someone else's evil choice. You know, talking about stories there, I remember as a kind of 18 or 19-year-old kid going out with a friend one evening and, you know, kind of late teens, sort of teenage hormones and overdrive, etc., etc. And we were wondering where to go to possibly get a date, and we had a number of options. We ended up going to a disco that obviously dates me. It's now nightclubs, as far as I know. Use disco, you're a kid of the 70s or early 80s. But on our list was Le Mans, and we didn't go, Le Mans Hotel. We ended up going to the Highwayman, which was a pub or a disco in a little town outside Belfast. But on that Friday night in Le Mans, the IRA hung bombs on the outside of the building and incinerated literally 12 people who were there in part of the hotel at a kind of dog collie dinner. But very easily, again, I may not be here today. I could have been incinerated, as someone in my teens in the 1970s. So sometimes it is the bad choices or evil actions of others. We do live in a sin-corrupted world. As a result of the fall, humankind spirals into spiritual chaos and death. The Bible says even nature is adversely affected. So tornadoes, floods, earthquakes, droughts, natural disasters. So no sin, no famines, no disease, no death. And Satan storms. Because very plainly, in John 10 and verse 10, Jesus said that Satan's mission is to steal, kill, and destroy. So there's no doubt that some of the trials and hardships we face can be attributed to the evil one. If you were here yesterday towards the end, we were looking at the book of Job to a slight degree and trying to wrestle with those sort of chapters 1 and 2, that sort of drama between Satan and God. And if you remember the quotation that I said, sometimes God must appear to be the loser on planet Earth in order to be the winner of unseen battles taking place in the heavenlies. So in other words, no one in this room has that aerial overview of everything that is happening in the cosmos. So you look at those four factors. Do they answer the question about why tragedy comes into our lives? Definitely no. The truth is, there are questions we will wrestle with until we die. So what do we do? How do we muddle through this chaos we call life? How do we deal with these storms? At the beginning of Psalm 46, David says, God is our refuge in trouble, a present help. Therefore, we will not fear. Your theme at Holden is fear not. So David is saying, if your world is collapsing, look to God. And if you ask a person who has been following Jesus for many years, try this question. Tell me a time or times when you have felt closest to God. You know what I'm going to say. The answer is invariably, it was during a time when they were going through some kind of storm. They find and they experience that God is a refuge, a shelter from danger. And so, too many times we have this head knowledge about God. We sing hymns about it. We read Bible verses about it. And if we're caught up in this storm suddenly blowing into our lives, the songs go, the verses go, and panic sets in. And David's advice in Psalm 46, even though at times there will be when we shake our fist at God, and we have talked about that, he's saying, don't spend your years asking why. Turn to God, trust in God, take refuge in God. In the fall of 1991, a car that was being driven by a drunken driver jumped its lane and smashed headfirst into a minivan driven by a gentleman called Jerry Sitzer. He and three of his children survived, but his wife, his four-year-old child, and his mother died in the crash. And over the years, I still have this book from way, way back in the 90s. He wrote a book of his own reflections about grief, about loss, about suffering, and the book's title was A Grace Revealed. And in the book he shares his following story about how his son David responded to the tragic accident. He says this. He says, "My son David is and has always been quiet and very reflective. After the accident, he was the least likely to talk about it. But when he chose to, he always seemed to have the most significant thing to say. I had to be ready to respond to him when he sent cues indicating to me as his dad that he was ready to talk." He says, "The best conversations happened in the car." And he says, "One particular conversation is set really fresh in my memory. David was 8 at the time. We were driving to a soccer match some distance from our home, and typical for these occasions, David was quiet. The car was full of heavy silence, as if some question was brewing inside him. And it came. 'Dad, do you think Mom sees us right now?' He says, I paused to ponder. He says, 'I don't know, David. I think maybe she does see us. Why do you ask?' 'I don't see how she could, Dad. I thought heaven was full of happiness. How could she bear to see us so sad?' And so I asked the question, could Linda witness our pain in heaven? How could that be possible? How could she bear it?" And I said to my 8-year-old son, "I think she does see us. But she sees the whole story, including how it all turns out, which is beautiful to her. It's going to be a good story, David." And he continues and he says, "I could not even hazard to estimate the number of times I've been asked, 'How does Christianity address the problem of suffering?' The Christian's answer to suffering is God's suffering, Christ's resurrection. God knows pain within himself. God knows joy within himself. He knows the whole story as one, including how it all turns out." And I think people in 30 years of ministry who weather storms well, I think do so for three concepts. I think they have a living faith. And I think real faith begins when you come to God and say very simply and sincerely that I need you in my life. I have sins that need to be forgiven. I need direction for the future. I open my life. I need your strength. So it comes through a living relationship with God. And in relationships, as we alluded to yesterday, in Psalm 22, it's okay to say those questions, "I feel forsaken." To have the experiences of the C.S. Lewis, when you feel you hear the sound of bolting and double bolting and you can't get through to God. It's okay, as I said, as the Jewish rabbis say, if you haven't been angry with God, you need to question how real your faith really, really is. But we also need, as well as that living faith, we need true friendships. Ecclesiastes, if one person falls, their friend will help them up, but I pity the person who falls and has no person to help them up. Because some of life's hurts are so devastating that they're only bearable when the burden is divided. And that is one of the benefits, church, for all its faults. That's one of the benefits of being part of a real, living, vibrant church family. Sooner or later, you're going to need care and support. The journalist and the writer Bob Green tells the following story in his book. The book's entitled, And You Know You Should Be Glad, A True Story of Lifelong Friendship. He writes, there are a handful of people during your lifetime who know you well enough to understand when the right thing to say is to say nothing at all. Those people, and there will be at most only a few of them, will be with you during the very worst times. He said, in my life, during a very painful juncture, my wife died. I was numb. I felt dead myself in the hours after her death, as our children and I tried to figure out what to do next, how to get from R to R. The phone must have been ringing. I have no recollection of it at all. The next morning, one of those mornings when you awaken, blink to start the day, and then this dispiriting second later, realize anew what has happened, and you feel the boulder press against the earth with such weight that you fear you'll not be able to get out of bed. The phone rang. I answered it. It was Jack. I didn't want to hear any voice, even his voice. I just wanted to cover myself with the darkness. I knew he would be asking, is there anything I can do? But I should have known that he had already done it. He said, I'm in Chicago. I misunderstood him. I thought he said he was coming to Chicago. He said, no, I took the first flight this morning. I heard. I've flown in. I know you probably don't want to see anyone right now. That's okay. I've checked into a hotel. I'm just going to sit in the room in case you need me to do anything. I can do whatever you want or I can do nothing. He meant it. He knew the best thing he could do was to be present in the same town, to tell me he was there. And he did just sit there. I assume he watched TV or maybe did some work. But he waited until I gathered the strength to say, I need you. He helped me with things no man ever wants to need help with. Mostly sat with me. I knew I did not require conversation, did not welcome chatter, did not need anything beyond the knowledge he was there. He brought food for my children. And by sharing my silence, he got me through those days. So we need a living faith. We need true friendships. We need a strong spirit. I mean, all of us in this room know what quitting points are. We all do because at some time or another, we've experienced discouragement, setbacks when we say, I quit. And yet God's power and presence can give every believer the confidence to move through those quitting points. Because when you're facing a storm, it sometimes seems as if it will never end, you'll never be happy again. The truth is, it will end. But you need those three things to sustain you through the storms. A faith that is real, friendships that are true, and a strong spirit. How do we grow in those storms? Some of the most caring, compassionate people I have ever known are people who have experienced the devastation of a personal storm. And out of that suffering, they have developed genuine compassion and empathy towards others. There's a little cartooner of two turtles, I don't know why you've seen it, but one turtle says to the other, you know, sometimes I'd like to ask God why he allows poverty, famine and injustice, when he could do something about it. And the other turtle, in responding to this turtle, says, I'm afraid God might ask me the same question. Sometimes I'd like to ask why those of us in his building allow poverty, famine, and injustice, when all of us could actually do something about it. So Paul says clearly the reason why God comforts us in all our troubles is that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we have received from God. I think storms also help us develop deeper relationships. I think that's certainly been true in my family and in the church family. There's a certain strengthening and closeness that develops between people when they experience adversity together. And some of the work that I have done in negotiating, particularly with those involved in terrorism, I mean, I've baptized numerous children of those who pursued political violence. I remember a number of years ago, a very senior loyalist paramilitary being on holidays, and he had had some illness, and his wife rang me. Would you pray for Jim? Because of those relationships, it allows you to speak into people's lives. But I think storms also help us develop inner strength. Remember reading a long time ago, early missionaries to Africa who had to cross rivers and streams on foot before any bridges were built in those areas. So it was always the danger of being swept away by some current. And eventually, the missionaries learned from the Africans that the best way to cross a river is to find the heaviest stone you were capable of carrying and lift it to their shoulders. The kind of extra weight kept their footing solid, prevented them from being swept off their feet. So the storms we face are painful, but they help us develop inner strength. I think a further benefit to us, okay, which I haven't got up on this, so forgive me. Yes, it is. There are the storms help us grow spiritually. After you've experienced trial, and as you learn that God is faithful in seeing you through, you will find confidence to face future trials. You can say, God has never failed me in the past, so right now, in this present storm, I am going to trust him. Rabbi Zacharias, who is a very well-known Christian apologist based in Atlanta, Canadian by background, he said to walk away from one's faith because of unanswered questions about evil is to walk into a storm of unanswered questions about good. Let me just say that again. To walk away from one's faith because of unanswered questions about evil is to walk into a storm of unanswered questions about good. And Timothy Keller, who as many of you know is pastor of the very famous Redeemer Presbyterian Church there in Manhattan, he quite honestly says this: Christianity does not offer so much solutions to the problem of suffering. And I think we need to be honest and say that. But rather it provides the promise of a God who is completely present with us in suffering. Because it's only Christians who believe in a God who says, here I am alongside you, I've experienced the same suffering you have, I know what it is like. No other religion begins to offer that assurance. And Keller says after the World Trade Center tragedy, he said between 600 to 800 new people began attending Redeemer. And the sudden influx of people pressed the question, what does God have to offer me at a time like this? And Keller said quite succinctly and honestly, Christianity is the only faith that tells you that God lost a child to an act of violent injustice. Christianity is the only religion that tells you, therefore God suffered as you have suffered. And Philip Yancey tells a story that once he was part of a small group with a Christian leader who went through a hard time, adult, children into trouble, sleepless nights, expensive eternity bills. Then he's diagnosed with a rare form of cancer. Nothing in his life seemed to work out. He said, you know, I've no problem believing in a good God. My question is, what is God good for? And he said, in our little men's group, we listened to his complaints. We tried various responses, but he continually batted them all away. And he says, interesting, a few weeks later, I came across a phrase by Dallas Willard. And he said this, for those who love God, nothing irredeemable can happen to you. For those who love God, nothing irredeemable can happen to you. He said, I went back to my friend. And I said, what about that? Is God good enough for that promise? So as I said on Monday and on Tuesday, I've seen a fair amount of suffering in my conflict, too much. I've given up trying to answer the questions because I just think they are unanswerable. But I think in Christianity, God steps into human history. There's a story told there, I've often told it actually at funeral service, that Dietrich Riskell tells a story that as the Allies were literally carpet bombing Germany towards the end of the Second World War, and the city of Dresden was totally ablaze, and a German who was a believer who hadn't spilled into the ideology of the Nazis lay injured outside a railroad station while the whole city was totally ablaze. And as he lay injured, he looked and he saw this little inscription above the railroad station that said, beyond the stars, there must dwell a gracious Father. Beyond the stars, there must dwell a gracious Father. And this believer said rightly, I don't want to know a God that dwells beyond the stars. I want to know a God that bled. I want to know a God that experienced pain. I want to know a God that wept. And that's the God that's revealed in Jesus Christ, who spills through the incarnation into the chaos and the debris. And I have to remind myself, I mean, you know, the Bible, and when Jesus was on planet Earth, this was not written in a vacuum. I mean, the Jews were under the jackboot of the most efficient military machine on planet Earth at that time, namely the Romans. There was political chaos. We spoke about that in our faculty meeting this morning. We are in political chaos. There was a threat of war, of insurrection, of terrorism. You know, people often have criticized me in the church over the years for talking to people pursuing terrorism. And then I remind them, like, who the hell do you think Simon the Zealot was? One of Jesus' converts. He was a first century Jewish terrorist. I mean, the zealot means he saw political violence as a way of overthrowing the Roman occupation. My mantra has often been over the years, engagement is not endorsement. Because Jesus modeled for me, in the midst of suffering and pain, he spoke to every person. He didn't endorse their worldview, but he spoke to them. And the classic example of that, as you know, was the Roman centurion, where Jesus talks to the occupier, to the oppressor, and then comes out with that riddle almost of a statement, I have not found so great a faith in all of Israel. So, in our study, as I said to you, we looked at lament yesterday. For those of us who were faith leaders during our conflict, some ministers did, I guess the phrase I've often used, they ended up what I call chaplains to their own tribe, refusing to engage with the other. It's a nice place to be. And as I've used the quotation when I was here at Holden last year, most people in our churches did not have guns in their hands, but they most certainly had them in their hearts. Okay, so it's a question of attitude as well. So attitude can bring about suffering. Bad theology has brought about numerous examples of suffering. Slavery, apartheid, the Holocaust. I will argue strongly that the roots of much of our chaos is bad theology. People don't like that being said, but it's true. In the Dutch apartheid church, as I mentioned the other day, bolstered up apartheid with a very elaborate system. Slavery was bolstered by apartheid. Our sectarian cockpit of Northern Ireland was bolstered by bad theology on both sides. So, one of the studies we looked at was we are all in this together. And as before, I'll pass these out. I'll try to walk us through it, and then we'll open up with a more corporate discussion around that. There should be enough for most people. If there isn't, if sort of everybody can see, and there's a number of folk up on the other tier there as well. I think Sharon has gone up to you guys. So with any additional ones, we can fling them in the middle there and folk can collect them.
To go back to number 2.
Yeah, by all means.
Okay,
tell me when to stop. Was that it?
Is that the last? Yes.
Yeah, that was number 2, yeah. I'll email that to you if you want anyway, or Sharon has it on her email as well, so just like an email it to you if you need it. So has everyone got sight of one of those sheets, hopefully? Yeah. So look, I'll try and read this slowly. Okay, so as I say, this spilled out of a number of folk within the Methodist Church trying to bring theology. The other thing to tell you about as well, how you use the word evangelical in this country is quite different to the way we use it at home. We would probably say your evangelicals here are primarily fundamentalists. They're not really evangelicals. I sometimes wish the church in the States, well, listen, you are the evangelical Lutheran church, so don't lose that word.
Yeah.
Redeem it.
Yeah.
Don't lose it. Redeem it. So in the sort of mid-90s, I was part of a group called Evangelical Contribution in Northern Ireland, where we try to get people to wrestle. How do we bring theological principles into the public space in the midst of suffering and conflict? So the first document we produced was entitled, tiny little pamphlet, 250 people, put their names to it. It was called For God and His Glory Alone. Why? Because of the idolatry of religious nationalism, as I mentioned to you the other day, the Ulster Volunteer Force, that was the leading loyalist paramilitary terrorist grouping on the British Protestant Unionist loyalist side. Their motto was For God and Ulster, the northeastern part of Ireland. And as you know, as well as I do, it's For God in America, For God in Germany. You know, I was involved in an interview there for Haaretz, which is a Jewish newspaper, in April when Joyce and I were speaking in Tel Aviv, and I did an interview, and I think I told you the title was Distorted Christian Theology Caused the Holocaust. And I got this mean email from some businesswoman in London who was nothing more than an anti-Semite, and she challenged me saying that. So I just simply quoted back to her Hitler's words in the second chapter of Mein Kampf. Here's what he said. Today, I believe, I'm acting in accordance with the will of God Almighty in ridding this continent of the Jews. So here's a person, Catholic background, not attending Catholic Church, but was drawing on distorted, exclusive Christian theology to destroy what ultimately ended up 6 million people. So let's try and just walk through this together, because we tried this in the Conai and we went on and produced a number of documents around that. So dealing with the past, as the writer says, there are healing hurts and memories, we all know, hugely complex. Even coming to an agreement about who is or who is not a victim is difficult. So another document we had the Eames-Bradley report. Robin Eames was the Archbishop of Ireland at one stage, and they put together this massive report on dealing with the past, 2 years of work, a lot of interviews, a lot of intensity. It's sitting on a shelf in Belfast, probably 3 miles from our home in the city centre, gathering dust. Why did it fail? Because one of the recommendations in the document was that every person's family who died in the conflict should get a payment of, I think, £12,000, $16,000. So you know where this is going. Are you going to give $16,000 to the family of a person who was a terrorist? Are you putting a terrorist in the same box as a police person, as a member of the security forces, as an innocent victim? So the whole debate began around who is innocent. Now I will say categorically and unashamedly, terrorism is fundamentally wrong. I know more about it than most people, and I spent my life working in it and acting as a persuader. But I have to ask the question, why do people pursue terrorism? Wrong as it is, so in my context, 30,000 people went through our penal system, maybe 40,000. And most commentators say clearly that the vast majority of them had been born in Wenatchee, New York, Rio de Janeiro, Dusseldorf, Paris or Vancouver, they never would have been in prison. So I ask the question, what made so many men of my generation, that was primarily men, turn into ruthless killers? Were they psychopaths? Well, here's the other statistics. Of those 30,000 to 40,000 who are now all released from prison, only 2% have reoffended. Why? What they did was wrong, and I fundamentally will argue that. They will argue with me, members of the IRA. There was no other way, Gary. This was the only way to do this. This was the only way to rid ourselves of the British, which in the end they didn't anyway. They had to compromise, as most conflicts have to at the end. But what drove those people to do that? I want to say bad politics, fed into it, and bad religion. So we can't even decide. I mean, I had an emailer 3 days ago, I was saying to Joyce, because our Methodist Church are doing this paper on legacy at the moment, because there's a sort of British government consultation around that. And so we can't even agree on the definition. So as I say, there are the sectarianism of victimhood is all so evident. We are real victims, they are not. So victimhood literally becomes a sort of guarded badge of identity. In my mind, we are always the victims, never the perpetrators. So as well as victims, survivors, there are those who cause suffering and loss. They're described as perpetrators. Acts of violence were unlawfully carried out by state forces as well as paramilitaries. We were fighting a war, is the frequent justification. But in our context, all of this happened not apart from, but within a community. So victims, survivors, perpetrators, we're not somehow outsiders. They all belong together in Northern Ireland or the Irish community. The term neighbours was often literally true. People knew and know. Now, I know. Joyce knows through my work. And the security services and the intelligence services know people who have committed mass atrocities that will never be in prison, because of lack of evidence. So you visualize that in a small space like Holden, that the person in your upstairs room killed your son. You see them in the grocery store. These are everyday occurrences back home. The remarkable thing sometimes is, and I was telling you yesterday about Alan and Linda, I think I mentioned it maybe in the sermon when I used some of those Israeli and Palestinian women that were with us recently. And I say this as a Christian minister. I mean, her 18-year-old son was stabbed to death by a bunch of sectarian loyalists. I'm putting my cards on the table. I am not sure if I knew who stabbed my 18-year-old son to death, could I hold myself back? I'm just being honest. So how do you square all that chaos? That in your village, in your shopping centre, you see the person who killed your father, your mother, your son, your daughter. And as we say there, we might wish it were otherwise, but then and now we're all bound in this web of interconnected relationships. We cannot avoid it. In your American context at the moment, can I say with all the controversy, the Republican Trump voters are not leaving America any more than the Clinton Democrat voters are leaving. You're going to have to share the space together. Israelis and Palestinians are going to have to share their space together. Catholics and Protestants are going to have to share their space together. And in some of our dark days, when things we felt were unraveling a little bit after the Good Friday Agreement, I remember facilitating some meetings after some serious street unrest and putting a number of options on the table and saying, yeah, you know, we can all go back to killing each other. People in the room thankfully said, we don't want to go there. So we're inseparably bound up in circles of symbosis. And as the hurt and loss occurred in this context, so too will the healing. We're all in this together, victims, survivors, perpetrators, community. We all are needing healing. We're all needing each other for healing. And we all need to share the responsibility of it. And this is why I'm arguing strongly, I don't care what the secularist says, but I want to argue strongly, theologically, we're describing the interrelationships between forgiveness, repentance, and community solidarity. So the latter is described in the Bible by covenant, a community of indivisible, inseparable relationships bound together by proximity and therefore called to solidarity. Study 5, as I said to you, I'm just doing 4 of these studies. If you want all of them, just email me and I'll bounce the whole thing through to you as a PDF once we get back to normal internet land, Sharon, as that can happen there. I think I sent you the full document and asked you to extract certain things there as well. So if you need those, Sharon, or...
have someone else post it on our website.
Okay, well, that's fine. I mean, because there's no copy. So if you need to adapt this to racism or whatever, I mean, there's no copyright. It's a PDF document produced by the Methodist Church. So by all means, use it where appropriate. So covenant is core to both parts of Scripture and is essentially about a vision of community. As we all know, covenants were common to all of Israel's ancient Near Eastern neighbours. Israel did not invent anything new, but took that covenant community idea from surrounding peoples and communities. But what was radically new was the just and egalitarian social vision that Israel's faith poured into the idea. So covenant was community and solidarity, sharing the pain, sharing the blame, and 4 core qualities marked covenantal community. And they're in Psalm 85. I'll just read those. Verse 10, love and faithfulness meet together, righteousness and peace kiss each other. So justice, equality, compassion, and truthfulness. So that's the kind of community I want to suggest in which recovery corporately, authentic healing takes place. So we've decided more or less in a democratic vote that we're not going to break into groups. We're going to do this corporately. So as a person, who are you? You may want to reflect on this for a minute and then we can ask questions. What are you for? The irony is most of us are known for what we are against rather than what we are for. And then ask, what do you require from each of the other qualities? And so we were doing this in groups. We would be, you know, round table, negotiating what each needs from others if a community is to experience a healing process. Justice, compassion, truthfulness, equality. So have a look at it maybe just for a moment, and then we'll corporately try to make some sense of this. Okay, does anyone want to wrestle initially with one of those qualities? I mean, what one of those four initially say, yeah, this is my, if I was asking you to grade them, this is my number one. Okay, I know the others are important, Gary, but this is my number one. Anybody want to kick off? Okay, this lady here, go ahead. Okay. Compassion, okay, this lady here. Compassion, this gentleman here. Okay, compassion's leading. Okay, let's do it like this here out of curiosity, okay. So who's the compassion people, okay? That's not meaning the rest are not compassionate, okay. So we're saying four there. Joyce, you trying to help me counting here, okay. So equality, who are the equality? Okay, two, okay. So at the moment, compassion are in the lead, but you're not going to win on the assumption everyone puts their hand up as regards the other. Okay, so the next one is truthfulness. Okay, you're in front at the moment. Finally, justice. Okay, so I think truthfulness maybe just edged it there, more or less. So anyone want to comment? So someone, why did you choose compassion? Go ahead. This gentleman.
If you don't have compassion, you're not going to get to the other three. You're not going to be wanting to be truthful.
Okay, yeah. And as we said yesterday, looking at the contrast between the Old Testament and the New Testament, when people ask the question, and we asked it today, does God care? I suggested the disciples probably never asked that question because Jesus was with them and he was moved with compassion. So it was this very visual, live, real example. In the Old Testament, they probably asked it. But during that period, the disciples just had to look at Jesus' face. He was, how many times did we see it? He was moved with compassion, a visible example. So we need compassion. Anyone want to wrestle there with one of the other concepts or comment on it? Yeah, go ahead, Kathy.
A theologian of the cross calls a thing what it is.
Okay. And that's a word I hear often back home. You know, we need the truth. We have to have the truth. We need to have the truth. So just let me make this even more complex, okay? Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, okay? It's often held up and as a model, Desmond Tutu, as you know, chaired that Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was reasonably successful overall. Like most of these things, invariably, you know, the people that did it, a bit like sort of Tony Blair and George Mitchell, who was one of your senators, did a brilliant job in chairing the Good Friday Agreement, but has suggested that the Good Friday Agreement is the template for the Middle East. I think I would, who am I to contradict a former British Prime Minister and a Democratic Senator, but I think I would rather say there are lessons from the Good Friday Agreement that would be applicable to the Middle East. So Truth and Reconciliation Commission, okay? Story is told of a 45-year-old black male who was murdered by the white South African police, and they made his 18-year-old son wash his hands in a basin containing his dead father's blood. Okay, true story. And then someone commenting on it, and you'll not answer this question, because I can't answer it. Someone said, how much truth can we take? So Kathy's saying truthfulness is crucial. I agree with you. Okay, no question about that. And yet someone's asking the question there, how much truth can we take? I mean, there's no answer to that in a sense. You know, that we look at my own context about victims wanting the truth. You know, we heard Alan's story at the beginning of the Keynes Mill. He held back the truth. So here's why you're all going to need each other, Kathy. You're going to need the truthfulness people. You're going to need the compassion people. Why did Alan hold that back? Compassion. for the other person. Okay? So that's why I'm trying to see these circles are all intertwined. Okay, so someone else now wants to come to me with another concept. Is there a justice person there who wants to speak up? Or sorry, Dick, come here. Hey, go ahead.
No, justice is fine first.
Okay.
I chose equality because
okay.
It's one I didn't want to choose.
Okay. Tell us why. Why did you struggle with choosing equality?
Yeah. But it is really hard for me with a lot of the issues going on in our world and especially our culture here right now.
Yeah.
To really have such strong feelings. Yeah. It's really hard to give equal status to some people. I cannot in so many ways. Okay. I cannot look at a person who's wearing a swastika somewhere in their body and see any sense of equality whatsoever.
Yeah.
But I have to see that person as God's creation, the child of God. And that is really hard.
Yeah.
But I know it has to happen. So that's why I chose it.
Okay, good, okay. So is there a justice person going to help me why they chose justice? I know who some of you are. Don't have me picking you out, putting you on the spot. So who's going to be the justice person? Chuck, or I'm going to hassle you, or Laura, I think you were a justice person there as well. I know you well enough to put you on the spot. You'll not growl at me. But isn't it amazing there, you know, the way, you know, Psalm 85 was written, 3,500 years ago, in and around there, perhaps. And here we are, you know, 21st century, early part of the 21st century, looking at these ancient principles that were as relevant then as they are relevant today. But none of them are stand alone. You do know what I mean? It's that we need that community. We need that interlocking together. And I suppose, Chuck, and you know well some of the work I'm doing back home in a sense, that in that visit that Joyce and I did to those border areas, here is the painful part of all this and the unanswerable. So 30 years of a conflict in the Irish context. We have more victims groups nearly in Northern Ireland than we have denominations. All with different shades of political opinion, some trying to bridge both communities, some totally single identity within either the Republican side of the fence or the Loyalist side of the fence. So here's a real life conversation that took place May, I guess, last year, June maybe, Joyce, and we were in Fermanagh. A lady, I am guessing in her late 60s, said to me, "I will only sleep in my bed when justice is done in relation to the death of my aunt and uncle who the IRA shot dead as two innocent Protestant civilians." Took place sometime in the 70s. I can tell you now, categorically, the people that did that murder will never be caught. And the majority will not be caught. Because as part of the Good Friday Agreement, even if they are caught, they will just serve 2 years in prison. That was part of the compromise to get us all over the line. And so this lady wakes up probably every morning wanting justice for her aunt and uncle. What are some of the reasons she'll not get justice? DNA and forensics in the 70s are not what they are today. The second reason is the people that did the murder in the first place could be dead. The third reason that was so chaotic then, that the police were trying to hold back a community from totally destroying each other, that records just were not kept of every single thing. This is in the middle of a civil war zone. So I said to this lady, I want there to come a time when you find some healing. Could you imagine if we're still alive in 20 years' time and we're still having this conversation. So how, in that concept, so I'm just being devil's advocate, if she never finds justice in a penal sense, okay, because that's what she's looking for, so we need to kind of name that, okay, I want somebody behind bars. Is there another way that she finds healing? That's not easy. How do you do that? So all of those, as I was telling you the story of those, something like you were watching recently, George, or Linda was saying to us about those 10,000 Bosnian Muslims who were murdered by the Serbs during the breakup of Yugoslavia. Chances of those people being caught, pretty remote. You may get a big name trial at The Hague, but the actual trigger people, it's highly unlikely. So then you've got to spill into that whole concept of forgiveness, which is very, very problematic. C.S. Lewis said, everyone says forgiveness is a lovely idea until we have something to forgive. So it is. So how do we... Any other... So any thoughts on that? Because I know there's a real... I mean, the story I told last year, I'll tell this story and then just open it up for folk, you know, stories told that Christmas Eve 1983, when Pope John Paul II went into the Rabiba prison in Rome to meet Ala Alagat, who was the Turkish-born terrorist, who had attempted to kill him, if you remember, 2 years earlier. And if you remember the scene, it was recorded. It was a wordless scene. The two men sat in a very bare prison cell, their heads pretty close together. Eventually, the Pope came out of the prison surrounded by a media scrum, and they said to him, well, Holy Father, what did you say to him? He said, I said this. I spoke to him as a brother whom I pardoned. I spoke to him as a brother whom I pardoned. Now, Time magazine picked that story up, and if you remember the Time magazine a long time ago, probably early 84, it was a black cover with a red question mark with the question, why forgive? And Lance Morrow, who was then senior editor of Time magazine, and I'm kind of paraphrasing him, saying, Christ preached forgiveness. The loving of one's enemies, it is at the center of the New Testament. Stated nakedly, superficially, the proposition sounds perverse. A recipe for disaster. The idea that is more akin to this world, and you Americans will know this phrase, is more akin to the mentality of the High Plains drifter. Think Clint Eastwood. Okay. To a kind of cold, numb remorselessness, the cold eye of the avenger. But he finished his article with these words. As a secular journalist writing for Time magazine, he said this, forgiveness does not look like a tool for survival in a bad world, but that is exactly what it is. Forgiveness does not look like a tool for survival in a bad world, but that is exactly what it is. So those four principles are in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament, they're important. But we need to spill in this concept of forgiveness as well, which is another principle. So any, we have about 10 minutes left. Any further thoughts on those? The sort of plenary bit there at the bottom kind of says, you know, if we're all in this together, if we believe we are, what, in your context, what concrete action is required? Because this can just end up, as I say, I've tried to do this sort of Wesleyan theology, personal holiness and social holiness. So sort of preaching in the psalm is that sort of personal holiness. This is what I call this engagement here is social holiness. So how does this spill out into the public space? Either that, it just becomes a kind of cerebral, theological exercise. It may help me, but me alone. It will never spill out into the wider context in which I live. So anyone want to comment on those four principles, or how does that spill into American society? What does it look like?
I think first you have to have
sort of calm.
Yeah. Our churches in the United States is holding, creating a space where antagonistic groups hear one another. Or has everyone come to hold and think the same way? More or less. I dare say you do. So for next year, do you ask a Democrat, a white supremacist, a theologian, and a psychologist to come on a panel and hear their story? What shaped these people to think the way they think? I was in the United States there in March speaking on civil dialogue in uncivil times, and I really did, and they kind of didn't want me to do it. Time didn't permit. I would love to go out for a beer with a white supremacist because I want to hear your story. Because I believe some of you have told me, Gary, we want our own homeland. Oh, really? Really? Tell me, define that as a white person, what that looks like. Well, we want a certain state or region just to be ours. Okay, so you want to, like, you really just want to live a life for like, yeah, I really do. Okay. Tell me how that's going to look in 2050 when white people in the United States are not in the majority.
It's going to be a fortress.
Yeah. But when the other people, possibly who are not white like you and me, Mr. White Supremacist, end up in control, they might dismantle your little reservation. Have you been futuristic enough to think 30, 40 years in advance? Tell me your fears. What are your concerns? What has shaped you as a human being? Can I suggest to you that probably the only way this nation is going to survive in the long-term future is through sharing this space, is through some meaningful integration, is understanding the other. Are Israelis forever doomed to fight war after war after war, as some believe they are? Or is there a way we can share space together? Because in our context, we had to make some serious compromises in 1998 to get us over the line. Can you imagine what it was like for people whose loved ones had died watching the gates of those prisons open and mass murderers walk out? I'll tell you, it was not easy. So, tell me, what should Holden be doing? Tell Chuck, tell the Vice President of the Board, hassle those people. Where should this be shaping? What uncomfortable conversations does this organization need to facilitate to allow faith to spill into the public space? Go ahead.
So, I'm just asking more questions.
Okay, go ahead. I'm not, don't assume I'll give you answers.
Better than conflict resolution. Mm-hmm. And I've been trying to think about what does that mean?
Okay, yeah. Okay.
And the other thing, I'm going to Roy's session, and he keeps talking about fighting the long fight. And I'm trying to just kind of put all those things together.
Okay. I will weave that, and I know where Jeff's coming from in relation to that. The conflict management is important, but you can't press the pause button on that. Yep. John Paul Lederach, who many of you know, Mennonite scholar at Notre Dame University, his mom and dad, John and Naomi Lederach, when they retired in Goshen, Indiana, decided they needed some excitement in their lives, and they worked with me for 2 years, literally on a Berlin-type wall and interface in their middle 60s, wonderful couple. Mennonites. And their son is moved that even the phrase conflict resolution is not enough. You need conflict transformation. So the difference between conflict resolution, so you resolve or you stop the war, But how do you transform the climate or the context that caused the war in the first place? So how do you transform, or if you want me to use a Christian word, redeem the climate that caused it in the first place? So I think we in this room should be about transforming society or redeeming society with all those words that we have been pulling together. And I think that's so important. John Paul and Eric also says, and I'll chat in a minute, Eric, and maybe Sharon try to get this up maybe tomorrow. John Paul Lederach has this thing. I mean, you just Google it. Try to remember this. Just do John Paul Lederach's pyramid of conflict transformation. Okay, so visualize my hand. Okay, so triangle. Okay. And at the top, which is a very small percentage, are senior politicians, senior military people. And then in the middle are, you know, academics, clergy, professors. And then at the bottom is the mass of society. Lederach argues very, very strongly that the middle tier is the most important tier, because the middle tier has access to the top and also to the bottom. So most people in this room, I mean, some of you I know, are middle tier people. You have access up and access down. You know, so, and that's why I hope my ministry and my calling has been reasonably effective, because I've cultivated those top relationships, but also those bottom relationships. You know, so like 4 days ago, I was emailing Bertie Ahern, the former Prime Minister of Ireland, 3 times. And we will travel together to Israel to speak in November. But I was also emailing people a couple of days ago who are at that bottom strand. So that's what I'm saying to you. And we're going to talk about this, I think, a little bit using the model of the Good Samaritan tomorrow night during the sort of faculty vespers gig tomorrow night there, that all of us in this room can be incredibly effective. Okay, final 4 minutes left. So that's all. Did I see a hand I haven't asked? Let me try to bring some. Okay, go ahead. I haven't brought you in yet.
I think that the younger generation will be more accepting and maybe better at conflict.
Yeah. I mean, my hope is yes, and I kind of said yesterday as regards the millenniums, I used that phrase that David Fitch uses in his book, The Great Giveaway, where he talks about that this generation are looking for authentic community. So they don't want something that's false or marketed or packaged. I mean, that's why the kind of mega church movement, and I want people to come to faith. I'm glad they come to faith through the mega church movement. I just still feel there's a bit of too much advertising and glitz. I think our millennium generation see through a lot of that, you know, high-powered stuff, in a sense, which is more performance than really authenticity. But that generation also needs leadership as well and example. So they do. And that, because I look like, you know, I came to faith in my sort of mid-20s from a background of agnosticism, and, you know, I needed older mentors and examples to move me along. You know, I remember when I did come to faith, for the first 2 years, bi-weekly, the church I was attending allocated one person to meet with me twice a month for 2 years. You imagine how it shaped me as a like kid in my mid-20s. Who helped me? Do we do that now? You know? Dick?
Well, this is, you've been saying this, but for us churches here, I think we've been really good at being hospitals instead of communities for healing. And we have pastors who are really chaplains. I mean, that so often is what happens. Instead of being intentional communities of reconciliation.
Yeah.
And I think that's really what we need to do as churches, is to be intentional communities of reconciliation, the body of Christ in the world. And to show people, invite people to come and be part of that.
Yeah. I mean, the statistic, Laura, that you used the other day, which is one you will know it better than I do, because it's your discipline, it's not mine. But Were you said in 1964.5%? You tell it. You know the line better than I do.
Yeah, that was a survey of American respondents. In 1964.5% of respondents answered affirmatively when asked if it would bother them if their son or daughter married someone of a different political party. And by 2010, the figure was, I think it's 43%.
3%, yeah.
Something stronger than bothered, or displeased or unhappy or something like that if their son or daughter married someone of a different political persuasion. Yeah.
Me, I mean, I as a European, an outsider, who want to ask these people, are you out of your minds?
Yeah.
Really? Are you absolutely out of your mind? I would want to be saying, I would love to rephrase that, people, particularly to those who are evangelicals. Would you rather your son married if you did vote Republican, a Republican or a person who's a follower of Jesus Christ? The irony is, you know, as I've often kind of said back home, some Christians back home are more in love with the Union British flag than they are with Jesus Christ. Some Christians here are more in love with the Stars and Stripes than they are with Jesus Christ. Some Christians back home are more in love with William, Prince of Orange, than they are with Jesus Christ. Well, I unashamedly, I am sticking my colours with Jesus because he's eternal and he's lasting and flags fade and don't last. Eric, you were wanting to say something there.
I've been part of the multiplicity conversation that's been happening earlier before this session each day. And I was meditating on, you know, how do we move forward, transform. And it occurs to me that learning to see the other as an assemblage of selves rather than, you know, pigeonholing, seeing the other only as former terrorist, victim, whatever.
Yeah.
So if we're all an assemblage of different selves, and we learn that more about ourselves and are able to recognize that in others, that maybe creates space for us to see the other as a more fully human than a pigeonholed identity. And so I think there's something very valuable about that.
Yeah. And I want to say, look, for you folk in this room, your American citizenship is important. I have two passports, both British and Irish, because of our peace agreement. We can designate ourselves as either, in a sense. But I do want to say this categorically and strongly. Paul reminds all of us in this room that our citizenship is in heaven. So my primary passport, on the assumption I'm a believer and follower of Jesus Christ, is an eternal passport stamped by Jesus. And that is not diminishing my Britishness or Irishness or Americanism, but it's asking people in an eternal framework. The A.W. Tozer, the old evangelical mystic of another generation, evangelicals, I mean, as you would know, Roy, better than most of us, could never get Tozer because he read the people that you have poured your life into, Bernard of Clairvaux and people like that. I couldn't get, why is this evangelical drawing from these resources of people who don't share our theology? You know, because God was in those writings. That is why. You know, that is the reason. And, you know, we still, and Tozer's quotation that I actually think I still have on my desk, and it wasn't superficial, where he said, God, keep me eternity conscious. God, keep me eternity conscious. And that's not veering so much in the heaven you forget about planet Earth, but there is a total framework around all this. A national identity is not the most important. Trust me, it's not. So look, we're after 12, so we'll finish there and thank you and think dinner is served in that sense.